Got three bills today. We'll start out with Senate Bill 89 and do a public hearing and maybe move into a work session on that one. And then after it, Senate Bill 99 and 165, if there's anybody out there that's waiting to testify on those. And I don't anticipate that any of these three will take all that long, and so I'm guessing we're not going to be here the whole time. And a couple of our committee members have got other engagements that they need to get to before 5 o'clock, so I'm anticipating we'll move pretty quickly. But given that, we'll start out with Senate Bill 89. Can I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 89? And Sue, if you could give us a rundown.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This measure extends by 2 years a sunset on pilot project allowing temporary transfer of water rights in certain irrigation districts until June 30th, 2010.
Phil Ward and Debbie Colbert, why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yeah, thank you, and I know you're both pros at this, but go ahead and state your name for the record and then launch in.
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Phil Ward. I'm the director of the Water Resources Department, and I wanted, as our first agency bill before your committee this session, I wanted to come and introduce myself and introduce Debbie Colbert, who's with me today, who will be doing our primary legislative work during the session. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll ask her to introduce herself and explain the bill.
Yeah, please do.
Again, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator with the Water Resources Department. And Senate Bill 89 is a bill that was filed by the governor on behalf of our department. And it essentially extends an existing pilot program for an additional 2 years. The program would sunset in 2008. The bill is asking to extend that through 2010. And the pilot program is... The intent of the program was to see if there were opportunities to give districts more flexibility to move water around within their districts without losing any of the protections for existing water rights that we other existing water rights. So this program was set up under Senate Bill 820 in 2003, and it identified three irrigation districts that would participate in the pilot program.
Oh.
And it includes Talent Irrigation District, Tualatin Valley Irrigation District, and Oahe Irrigation District. And essentially we're asking for the extension through this bill because it the first 2 years of having this pilot program in place, the department needed to do some rulemaking and other work to get ready to start the program, and also the participating districts had some work on their end to get ready in terms of how they were managing their districts. And so we've only really gotten two irrigation seasons under our belt in the pilot program, and we'd like to have a couple more to see so that we can thoroughly assess how it's worked.
I think, Mr. Chair, with that, we'd be happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
I don't think we're quite done yet. I understand you're now a doctor. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I got my PhD from Oregon State University in their oceanography program.
Go Beavers.
Well, yeah, if you're going to do it anywhere, that's the place to do it, isn't it? Congratulations.
Thank you.
Sure. Committee, any questions? Senator Pozanski.
I'm just wondering, based on the two seasons you have, do you have anything to report back as to what's going on or how it's working or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, we basically are preparing a full report to the legislature, but a survey of our water masters in those areas has concluded that there's been no injury or enlargement issues raised by the pilot changes that have happened so far, and also we haven't gotten any other third-party complaints of injury and enlargement in those areas.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I'm in one of those water districts and pay into it every year and have acreage under it, and I didn't know a thing about this, either I'm ignorant or they're not telling us everything down there. What are you really trying to, probably a little bit of both, or probably the latter, what are you trying to accomplish with these things? What's the real goal here? To conserve more water, to transport other people? What's the real goal?
I think the goal is to give districts more flexibility and streamline what they have to do in terms of applications and fees to move water around on a year-by-year basis. It helps them to be responsive to their customers, this ability to move things around quickly. And it also saves them money because they're not paying the current application fee would, at a minimum, be $175 per transfer. So it saves them money as well. And less workload for the department if we can demonstrate that it can be a success and that there's sufficient and responsible management occurring in these districts.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'll talk to you in private later. I don't understand what you're really trying to do here. I think I see a lot of wastage in our district. We have a lot of issues to work on. I'd like to see more water in the streams, less in our lands, if we get the same results. And some people have needs for it at a certain time of the year. Some have needs for other times of the year. If that's the kind of thing you're talking about, then that's great. I'm just not quite sure what you're trying to accomplish as well with your pilot programs.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and Senator, and I'd note that Anita Winkler's in the hearing room today, and I hope she'll bring some of the irrigation district perspective to this discussion. But I think it's really about allowing the district to function as a more flexible structure in terms of how they move water to different lands that need it and off of lands that don't. So to allow the district to respond to the kind of things that you just mentioned. So what are the needs in the district? How, indeed, can we allow these districts to function with some oversight, but to function more independently than they have in the past and not have to ask us every time they want to move water from one spot to another?
Senator Atkinson?
I think for Senator Bates, our family was on TID, so let's say hypothetically that the Atkinson Ranch is flood irrigating and the Bates Ranch, which is down a little bit further, needs some water, and he and I have worked it out, and I don't need as much as I'm using. Can this pilot program help me help him?
The district and the landowners within the district will still be limited by the total amount of acres and volume of water that they can divert. But it does, those kind of scenarios could happen where maybe you don't need to put water on as much land one year, and so you work out an agreement with the district and your neighbor that perhaps those lands, that he could cover more lands in his area.
So, Doctor, though, but by working with the department under the pilot project through TID, temporarily not using it as much one year, in no way risk my water right.
That's correct. It's the pilot program is just for annual place of use changes only, and so at the end of the irrigation season, all of the water rights revert back to their original locations.
So those are the data points that the pilot project is collecting.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense to me.
And I wonder if you could, before you step down, too, just very succinctly be a little clearer about what the next 2 years gets you that you haven't been able to get so far.
Mr. Chair, I think what it does get us, what we hope it gets us, is a larger track record in terms of more districts actually implementing this program on the ground. We haven't had a lot of implementation, frankly, to this point, and we feel like, as an agency, we need to see practically some more implementation before we would endorse the pilot going away or making it permanent. So we'd like to, we need a 2 more years to do what we would view as a better evaluation as to the utility of the program, whether it's useful, and two, whether it works within the constraints of Oregon water law, protects existing and historic rights.
Senator Pozanski?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The only thing I don't see here, Phil, is any extension or requirement to give some type of report back to the legislature. Possibly one of the original bills did, but if it does, that I don't know if it actually refers or relates back to retaining that obligation, but that's what I think I'm hearing, is that at some point we want to know, some report.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pruszynski, the Senate Bill 89 would have the department reporting back to the legislature in January 31st, 2009.
There's a report. Okay.
All right. Very good. Anything further? Okay. Mr. Ward, Dr. Colbert, thank you. Anita Winkler. I must say, Dr. Colbert, it was Senator Atkinson that clued me into your recent success. I think you've got a fan. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Ibaki and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We're the trade association representing irrigation district, water control districts, and similar entities that deliver irrigation water around the state of Oregon. This proposal 2 years ago was originally our bill, and I'm here today to first off thank the department for their effort to request this extension of the pilot project and obviously to support the bill. You have in front of you some brief written testimony. I don't really want to read it because it's actually, I think, almost longer than the bill itself is. So I think what I'd like to do is just to quickly tell you that the three districts that have been eligible to use this have been excited is probably an understatement of having this tool available in spite of the fact it hasn't been used extensively. It took a little while, as usual, to get the rules on the ground, and then once we knew the rules, the districts had to put some processes in place, and that just all takes time. And we all agreed we wanted to take time to make sure they got it right, that when this kind of project was underway, we needed to get it right, we needed to have good public records, and everybody needed to know what the information was. So it was a little slow getting up and running. The other thing that hit, oddly enough, is this was driven by drought conditions, with districts seeing this as a good tool to manage water in a short water year. You passed the bill, and it started to rain. I'm not sure there's a direct connection there, but we've had much better water years since then, but maybe we want to run a test to see if there's a connection with another bill like this later on. So the districts are very interested in continuing. We have several other districts who are watching carefully and would very much like a chance to participate once the pilot project is over. They see it as a great management tool, not only because it does save some money in the fees, but it does mean that they can get the water moved instead of having to wait to get other kinds of approvals and get other processes done, and so that the water is more efficiently used. With that, I'll be happy to answer some questions.
Nothing. Thank you very much. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 89 and open a work session on Senate Bill 89. If somebody can give me a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 89 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion?
This is a great opportunity for somebody to carry somebody's water.
Any better jokes or further discussion?
I know who's carrying the bill.
Yeah, I know who'll be carrying water now. That's for
with
sure.
With a conflict, too. That would be great.
Yeah. We'll have a conflict.
Good. Okay, then. Any objection? Good. Seeing no objection, then the motion carries. And Senator Bates, you'll be happy to carry the bill, I'm sure, for us. And I close the work session on Senate Bill 89. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 99. And so if you could give us a rundown on that, Mr. Davis, if you don't mind, would you see if there's any, or do we have the sign-in sheet already? Anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 99? Okay, we'll get there. We'll get there then. Thanks.
Good. This measure revises Forest Land Urban Interface Fire Protection Program. It allows a state forester to enter into cooperative agreements with local governing bodies or homeowners association, modifies ability of state forester to designate and classify forest land urban interface lands, reduces quorum requirements of county classification committees, defines term members' term limits, modifies obligation of landowners to minimize fire hazards. And we have received several letters that I'll just that are included in your packet. Carl Jansen, president of the Upper Deschutes River Natural Resources Coalition, wrote a letter of support. Gary Marshall, deputy chief fire marshal, City of Bend Fire and Rescue, also a letter of support. Sherry Holliday, Wasco County Commissioner, writes a letter of support. And there was one letter suggesting a modification submitted by David Moskowitz, Executive Director of the Confluence Consulting Firm.
Rick Gibson, why don't you come on up? Actually, Mike, why don't you come on up, too? You don't mind sharing the desk, I'm guessing.
Well, I keep that one to yourself for at least till this bill's over.
Mr. Gibson, why don't you go ahead and just state your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Gibson. I'm the Fire Prevention Director with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 99 this afternoon. Five sessions ago, the legislature enacted the Oregon Forestland-Urban Interface Fire Protection Act of 1997, which is a title that doesn't easily roll off the tongue, so we still, to this day, call it Senate Bill 360. The legislature enacted that legislation, and the purpose of the act was to prevent the loss of homes during large wildfire events, and the passage came on the heels of several wildfires which had destroyed dozens of homes. Since the early 1970s, even with Oregon's land use planning program, the rapidly growing population has expanded dwellings further and further into traditional forest land areas. And the wildland-urban interface created by this expansion has increased the number of homes at risk to fire, and that's especially true in the fire-dependent ecosystems that we find in southern, eastern, and central Oregon. So far, Oregon, relative to its neighbors in the other western states and the Canadian provinces, has really dodged the bullet. British Columbia, Alaska, Washington, certainly California, all those other states have lost hundreds of homes at a time. So far, like I say, we've dodged the bullet. The most we've lost, I think, is 42 at one time. We've had several fires take out 30 to 40 homes at a time. So we feel very fortunate. We'd like to maintain that. The original Senate Bill 360 was sponsored by the Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee, and it required the Board of Forestry to adopt standards which landowners are then to apply on their property and which are designed to minimize or mitigate wildfire hazard risks. Initially, homeowners have 2 years to bring their property into compliance with the standards, and then once they've met the standards, they're to certify in writing that they have done so. Compliance is voluntary. The department does not conduct inspections, nor does it have any kind of an enforcement program. However, if a homeowner fails to apply the standards or to certify, they automatically become liable to the state for reimbursement of certain fire suppression costs up to a maximum of $100,000. And there's several other caveats attached to that. The fire has to start on the property, and it has to start or spread as a result of their noncompliance. And we're only allowed to get certain costs for certain types of suppression back. In passing Senate Bill 360, the legislature directed the department to take a slow and thoughtful approach to implementation, and I believe we've done that. So far, the act has been very well received by both landowners and by local governments. Implementation is taking place county by county on a priority basis, based upon the risk of fire and on the number of homes that are at risk. And in a typical county, once we start implementation, it's a 3 to 4 year process. And we fully completed the process in Deschutes and Jackson counties. We're currently underway to one stage or another in 9 more counties. And we received the funding but not yet started in 5 counties. As the act has been implemented, we have found that some minor changes or adjustments to the original legislation would be appropriate. And that's the purpose of Senate Bill 99 before you today. And I'll give you some examples. I won't go through all of those that are on the testimony you're looking at, but I'll highlight a few of those. The first one, in some developments in Sun River is an example. The Homeowners Association has an aggressive program to deal with dangerous fuels. And when such a program substantially matches the standards called for under Senate Bill 360, we would like the clear authority to enter into a limited term agreement with the association to accept their standards rather than the state coming in and just brushing theirs aside and saying we're going to take over. When we do start implementation in the county, it starts with the formation of a county forest and urban interface classification committee. In most counties, that's a five-person body. The majority of those members are appointed by the county governing body. And currently, when a person is appointed to one of those county committees, it's a lifetime appointment. That's been somewhat intimidating to people, and so we're proposing terms of 4 years with any number of terms being possible. The original Senate Bill 360 contained an enabling section, which was not codified as a statute, and in that was the legislature's desire that homeowners be given 2 years to bring their property into compliance with the standards before they become potentially liable for that $100,000 liability. And so in Section 9, we would place that time frame into the statutes. Concern has arisen that landowners could be subjected to an unfair moving of the goalposts if the standards they are required to meet are modified too frequently. And an advisory committee appointed by the Board of Forestry recommended that we seek legislation which would limit an individual property owner having to adjust to revised standards no more than once in any five-year period. And Section 9 includes that recommendation. The present version of the Act makes the assumption that each piece of property has one owner, and especially in Central Oregon, that is not the case. Property at the end of the Seventh Mountain is a good example. One tax lot may have hundreds of owners, and it's unclear how the department or the owners are to apply the Act's requirements. And so we've asked for new proposed language in Section 9, which would allow us to work through such situations. And the last one I'll mention is the fact that the Act contains what amounts to a non-competition clause. And the intent of that clause is to allow local governments, if they so choose, to place into effect equal or stronger wildfire mitigation standards. This recently became an issue in Deschutes County where the Board of Commissioners was considering an ordinance that had standards pretty comparable to Senate Bill 360's, and which would have applied to most ownerships outside the cities of Bend, Redmond, and Sisters. But because of this non-competition clause, and because our standards only apply to forest land which is protected from fire by the Department of Forestry, that meant we would have had to cease our efforts in Deschutes County and back out and let them take over. And that was one reason that the county chose to back away from their effort to extend into those areas that aren't covered by Senate Bill 360. So, again, we're asking for authority to enter into a cooperative agreement with local governments in Section 2 of the bill that would allow us the flexibility to address conflicts such as this one. In summary, Senate Bill 99 would make adjustments to the Oregon Forest and Urban Interface Fire Protection Act of 1997, and those would improve the implementation process, would improve the overall effectiveness of the bill. And these, the bill addresses issues which have been raised by landowners, by local governments, and by the department. The department supports the bill, and I thank you for your time and consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thanks, Mr. Gibson. I'll tell you, why don't we get both testimony in and then do questions. Mr. Dykesill, why don't you give us your name?
Chair Bakken and members of the committee, for the record, Mike Dykesill, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council, Salem, Oregon. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 99 today. We work very closely, obviously, with the Department of Forestry and our managed industrial lands. We face an ever-increasing number of adjacent urban interface situations up against these managed industrial lands, and we're very pleased with the implementation and the acceptance of the public for these standards in adjacency issues to our industrial lands. I think it's very strong to use the experience of the Department of Forestry and and their experience in fire and fuels to translate to some very realistic goals for fuels treatments in and around homes as a fire prevention need. Very well received. It translates hopefully to better protection for property, their belongings, their neighbors, communities, firefighters, natural resources, the whole thing. So we're here basically in support of the program. I think we are very fortunate to have our lands protected by the Department of Forestry. I think no one in the room would disagree that that they're second to none with their aggressive and safe tactics. And I think to disagree with my esteemed partner here, I don't think they've dodged the bullet. I think they've shown pure success in managing a program, being prepared for it. I don't think there's any luck involved. I think it's skill. So we do disagree on some things. But I guess I'm spoiled. I get to deal with the Department of Forestry Fire Protection Program pretty much exclusively, and I'm always ecstatic at the continuous improvement process that once they go out with a statewide program, or even before when we're developing rules, there's a good cross-section of folks that have the ability to participate, make their concerns be known. And Senate Bill 99, in my view, is no more than a continuous improvement that once they've gone out, they've heard from the citizens, diverse nature of fuels, geography, Oregon citizenry, and have made some adjustments that are well warranted to continue the broad support for Senate Bill 360. So we're here to offer support today, and thank you for your time and consideration.
Very good. Committee? Senator Pazanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask if the council and if the department could just take in consideration that there is one letter here that we got. It's an email with some suggested changes. And since this is going to come back at some point, if y'all could just maybe look at it and see if there's any merit to those requests that this individual's put in. I don't know if it has any merit or not. We'll let Certified Smart tell us.
Do you have a copy of that?
No, I do not.
Okay. Well, we'll make sure. We'll make sure you get one before you go. Anything else?
Yes. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it's in here, but maybe you could talk to a question that I have. One of the problems we faced during the Biscuit Fire and several of the other large fires in Southern Oregon during that particular season and the fire season 2 years before was the different firefighting priorities that our Department of Forestry had and the federal government had on life, structure, forest. Are we currently in line with the feds, or are the feds currently in line with us on the importance of protecting structures, or does this bill in any way speak to that? Or
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, no, it doesn't speak to that, and I don't think we are aligned with the federal government. Our priority by statute is life, forest, land, structures, and the federal government is life, structures, forest, land. So we are not synced up. We manage to work that out on the ground more often than not, but statutorily we're not aligned on that.
Does the department have a need or a desire to be in sync with the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Agnes, I'm not sure that I can speak for the department on that issue at this point. You know, all things being equal, certainly we would like to be lined up. I'm not sure we're ready to compromise our current priority in order to match theirs, and I'm not sure that they would be willing to come over to our side.
Another topic for another bill.
If I could comment maybe as a follow-up, we had some excellent discussions in the off-season last year on some of those issues, and I think across the state, I think everyone would agree that there was a significant change in the attitudes of the federal government in addressing protection of private lands as a very high priority in any fire plans. So I think the winds of change are blowing, but I'm not sure it would blow to the point of actually changing that document.
A follow-up to that, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Attitudes only last as long as this given administration's in office, which is two more years.
Point taken.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. I've been a part of this plan, too, and you guys are going to hit me hard today. I've got a partial ownership in Sun River, of all places, so you get me twice here. How effective do you think this plan would be? And we've been really lucky the last three or four seasons. We've had wet seasons, not bad forest fires. And yet I see, continually see more homes being built in areas like Sun River and in areas in Southern Oregon. People are moving into those borderline areas where forest fire could destroy their homes. And we like living in those areas. How effective do you think this program would be in a real dry summer with really some tough fires like we've had in the past, like the Biscuit Fire and others, that the Grizzly Mountain Fire we had down there that was close to town? Do you think these programs are going to be really effective in helping us?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I do. The last couple summers have been pretty dry and have been pretty severe. Last summer we had a significant number above average fire occurrence. The number of acres burned on state protected lands was very low. We would attribute that to our aggressive initial attack. But to answer your question more directly, I believe the answer is yes, and we're continuing to gather proof. For example, in the Tollgate subdivision out of Sisters, when Black Crater fire, whichever was the first one over there this summer, the fire basically laid down on the ground when it hit the areas that had been treated, and that's exactly what we're after under this program. So we do believe it's very effective.
Just a quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. Do you need more compliance or a stricter program? Do you think what you're doing is appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I'm not sure I understand the question. We're getting pretty good compliance now where we're implementing the Act. And we feel the standards are right where they should be at this point in time.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson, you mentioned that two counties were completed, and you told us what those two counties were, and you said it had been started in nine others. Could you give us a list of where you started and where you're going so we have that information, too?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I can. We are underway to one degree or another in addition to Deschutes and Jackson in Baker County, Crook, Douglas, Josephine, Klamath, Jefferson, Umatilla, Wallowa, and Wasco. And we've secured funding for but haven't yet started in Coos, Curry, Lake, Union, and Hood River counties.
I hope somebody's got that down. I guess the tapes have it. If you can give that in writing, it would be helpful.
Yes, sir.
I don't write that fast.
If you could, when you submit that in writing, just give it to our committee administrator, Ms. Marshall. She'll make sure that everybody gets a copy of it. All right. Thanks, both of you, very much. Very helpful testimony. Is there anybody else here that would like to testify on Senate Bill 99? If not, I might just let the both of you know. This is a bill that I would like to move quickly towards a work session. If there's a need for the two of you to come, we'll certainly let you know when that happens. But if there's a particular need for us to have you back, then we'll give you some advance notice so you can be here. And if it looks like we're not going to need you back, we'll let you know that as well so you can plan accordingly. Given that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 99 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 165.
Mr. Chair, this bill expands State Board of Geologist Examiners' authority to investigate complaints, provides immunity from civil action or administrative proceedings for testifying or furnishing information to the board in good faith, allows the board to deny registration applicants for cause, establishes disqualification periods for persons whose certificate of registration is revoked, makes registration after disqualification period conditional. It gives the board authority to conduct investigations or disciplinary hearings and to take disciplinary action against registrant notwithstanding change in registration status, and it increases the maximum civil penalty from $1,000 to $10,000. Oh, and included in your packet is a summary that was provided by the Oregon State Board of Geologist Examiners.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, if you wouldn't mind, would you grab the sign-in? Actually, the senator's going to beat you to it.
The trifecta.
I think the senator is vying for your job.
I don't know.
Sure. Eileen Webb. Actually, John, is it Ram?
That's it.
John, why don't we start with you, since you live the furthest away. And while you're coming up, something I didn't mention to the committee last time that I wanted to is it's in most of the committees that we've served on, it's the protocol is if you have follow-up questions to go through the chair for permission to be recognized again. I'd rather not do that. Once I recognize you for a question, if you've got follow-up questions, just please feel free at your own discretion to go through your whole line of questioning. If the cross-examination gets too intense or too long, I'll probably intervene, but don't feel the need to go through me for follow-up questions. No, come on up. Where's John? There he is. That works.
Okie doke.
Mr. Ram, thank you for coming. Why don't you just go ahead and give us your name for the record and then begin.
Thank you, Chairman Avakian, and members of the committee. I am John Ream of 5088 Summerfield Drive Southeast in Salem. And I am a geological consultant in geotechnical work and in groundwater resources. I oppose the Senate bill for principles that you will discover in my testimony, which I have provided in written form. Unfortunately, I have five copies. I noticed there are six people on the board, but for the hearing, but is it appropriate to hand it? Can you? Okay. I'm going to reference specific sections and parts of the bill. In section two, I'm concerned about what is acting on good faith. It's not really an open question because what I'm talking about on October 10th, 2003, an expert geologist was hired by the board to review a geologist's report, which was a hydrogeology review. And this reviewer or the expert had not previously done that work himself. The form and content of a hydrogeology view was stipulated by Marion County planning rules, but the hired expert lived in Bend, Oregon. Something just doesn't square here as far as how you deal with in good faith. I'm having a problem with that, and I oppose this particular item in principle, sir. Section 2 and Part 3 are regarding immunities. If members and legal representatives of the Board of Geologists are enjoy immunities from legal action, I think the principle is that they must be bound by procedural statutes, and this board and the compliance committee have acted as if there are few. And I elaborate. During that same compliance committee meeting of October 10th, 2003, the compliance committee chairman informed the geologist that the meeting would be a friendly meeting. The meeting, which was a supposed give and take event, should have at least been governed by Robert's rules. It wasn't. The compliance committee heard testimony of the expert hired to review the man's work, and then they interrogated the geologist, and the committee chairman abruptly ended the meeting after about 6 minutes of questions from me. Now, once again, something doesn't square with that, and I'm not at all happy with if you're going to grant immunities, then there has to be some kind of responsibility by the geologist board to adhere to certain civil civilities. Finally, I think probably the best thing that I can say about this bill is Section 6, Part 1. The direction of higher civil penalties against small companies could run them out of business. This would be true of small geological firms and geologists like myself, gentlemen and ma'am, who operate out of their houses. The survival of small businesses is a high priority of state and federal government. This bill is upsetting. It's a difficult bill to deal with. It deals with men's and women's livelihood of small concerns or of individuals.
Well, would you talk for just a minute about the type of small business that you're talking about?
Okay.
Just give us a few examples.
Let's see. I think the kind of work we do, there's work where we have we get into political issues like citizens groups and things like that. Citizens of Spring Lake Estates come to mind. They want to speak about their own water. They don't really want a consulting geologist to be hired by one of their people or a neighbor to speak about groundwater, and they oppose that rigorously. They will convene meetings and they'll demand sessions and things like that. And that's a very difficult, highly politicized, very upsetting procedures. What the geologist is expected to do is adhere to Marion County statutes which require geological work. Geological cross sections describe the subsurface. A tabulation, a search and tabulation of water well locations and how deep those water wells are and how well they produce. And then a geological opinion as a geologist and stamped, certifying the due diligence, more or less, although they don't speak of it that way, but the diligence of work. Other geological work is done for counties and states, or the state for, like building bridges. The bridge has to be founded in a good place, or has to be a bridge must stand. So the work has to be done well, and a geologist is often hired to describe the thickness and lateral extent of good units upon which that bridge may be founded, such as hard rock.
Good. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, any other questions?
One.
Senator Atkinson.
To your knowledge, do you know if there was one event that caused the State Board of Geologic Examiners to introduce this measure? Is this a systemic problem, or is this a one incident and the agency reacted and wanted this bill?
It was the reason. Do I know? Yeah, I do. It concerns a geologist who's a friend of mine, who the geologist board found to be out of compliance and other things, and through testimony of this expert and through complaint by people at Spring Lake Estates. All is not as it appears. When I did similar work in the area and I asked to measure water levels in the wells owned by these people, each of them refused me. And so that a geologist from a certain consulting point of view, like another person who wants to subdivide in that area or nearby, is a geologist can't. It's been my experience that I can't get the information. The other person, basically some of these measures that the board wants, I'm really having a hard time with that question, Senator Atkinson, because it's kind of an opinion you're asking me.
It's all right. Did you get what you needed, Senator Atkinson?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Good. Good.
Yes, sir. I don't. I was going to actually respond to Senator Atkinson. I know that there was a situation in Eugene that involved maybe an expansion of a aggregate field, and I know that there was an individual who was a geologist, if I remember correctly, was from the University of Oregon, may not be practicing, but had had the qualifications and stuff, or at least that was what was alluded to. And there was a issue as to whether this person should be rendering the opinions that they were rendering. So, in answer to your question, I think there's been more than one situation where these assertions, truthful or with merit or without merit, have come before.
Hmm.
And so I'm not sure. There's other people that are going to be testifying. I don't know if they're going to be talking about any other instances, but I don't have. I just remember this was being one of those issues probably 4 years back.
Mr. Rem, thank you for coming down today. Appreciate it very much. Ms. Webb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman,
sure, come on up. Yeah, come on up both together. Ms. Webb, would you like to start?
Yes, my name is Eileen Webb, and I am currently chair of the board. I've been serving on this board since March of 2002. My area of practice is similar to Mr. Reams in environmental and groundwater geology. And I'd like to introduce Dr. Steve Taylor, my co-chair.
My name is Steve Taylor. I'm a faculty member at Western Oregon University and a registered geologist as well as vice chair of the board. I've served on the board for the past year. I've also been part of the compliance committee for the past year as well. Go ahead.
So basically what I wanted to introduce, Senate Bill 165, is with a statement that the board is charged with the responsibility of upholding and ensuring the quality of the work conducted by registered geologists in Oregon. And with that, we have had instances over the years to realize that some of our language needs a little bit of updating and housekeeping and revising, as we've been challenged with some of these events and compliance cases that have come before us, as Mr. Ream alluded. And with your permission, I'd just like to go through each point that is in your information in front of you and just make a comment about the reason.
Go ahead.
Okay. One of the things I'd like to mention is that we had one section of our statute removed because it included a clause that required a public person or anybody who wanted to file a complaint with the board to have to swear in that they were doing so. And we felt that this was an absurd hindrance that was still in our statute. So we'd like to remove that to make it easier for citizens to come forward if they find that they'd like to make a complaint about the practice. Also, we had an instance recently where a license was coming to the end of its term. License was just about to expire, and he requested to have his license terminated ahead of time. It turns out that he was already in hot water with the DEQ, and he wanted to try to avoid the board investigating some of the things that he'd been accused of, and DEQ was fining him for. So we'd like to recommend that that you approve Senate Bill 165 for this language that would allow us to continue to have the ability to investigate registrants even after their licenses have expired if we find so due cause. Let's see. Point number three outlines the process for reissuing registrations to revoked registrants. And this just clarifies our process that we already have. We can already reinstate revoked licensees if we so choose, if they qualify. But this language just clears it up to make it a little easier to process. Number four, the point here allows the board to investigate individual. Well, that's the one we just talked about, sorry. Number five, grants the authority of the board to deny an application for registration if fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation occurs in obtaining the registration. Again, it just allows us another mechanism by which to pre-screen applicants in order to uphold the quality of those that we certify to practice in the state. Number six, the issue of raising the level of the $1,000 per violation to $10,000 per violation. Yes, it would be nice if we could collect that if we needed to as a relief from legal fees. But really, we put that came up with that figure just more as a deterrent, so that people will be a little more careful in their work, realizing that this is a maximum fine. The last time we collected a fine was years ago, and it was a very small fine. And we're not out to just, you know, get money, but this is really just a deterrent. That was our main purpose.
Sure.
I don't leave anything out, Steve.
Dr. Taylor, anything else?
Yes, I would comment, and I just would point out that we have over 1,200 registrants. We have individuals coming into the state of Oregon from California, Washington, and other parts of the West. And we also, we handle in any given year anywhere from 5 to 10 complaints per year, both from within the profession and from the public. It is not, you know, on a case-by-case basis with which we make these recommendations. We have been working with the Attorney General's Office, our counsel, over the past several years, with a case in particular that was referred to by Mr. Ream previously. Some of these changes are a result of that, of those legal actions, and other changes are a result of just ongoing improvement of the laws and clarification, so that both the board and the registrants know explicitly what is required for professional licensure.
Thank you. Committee, questions? Senator Brzezinski.
I have one question, and it's really the number two, and I'm not sure if you covered that. That's the part that Mr. Ream brought up about the investigation, and where you have the right to give immunity to, and it says specifically for board members, staff, and volunteers who serve as experts at the request of the board. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a little bit more, background as to how that came about, and is this something that's the norm for other boards or agencies that we have within the state?
Senator Brzezinski, this was a point that we wanted to bring forth based on advice from our Assistant Attorney General's office. This that it is very common for other boards to implement. I am quite familiar with the case that he's talking about. I could expand a little bit more about that if you'd like.
I haven't looked at the bill close enough. My one concern would be, Mr. Chair, it does say civil or administrative agency action. So civil, if it's limited within the agency, that's one thing. But if somehow we're granting civil immunity from some civil action that someone may take through a court, I would question that ability to provide that type of immunity, and also maybe misinform an individual that they think they have immunity where they may not.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I had the same concern on that provision. If you want to give us, if you're not prepared to today, that's fine. If you want to give us more information after talking with your AG again about why that piece was included, that might be helpful. Or if in rethinking it, you don't think it needs to be included, you know, then maybe an amendment. But if you want to comment on that, that's fine. And in addition, I'm curious what your criteria was for making the jump to $1,000 to $10,000, and if you have any knowledge about how that relates to what other boards or commissions do in their penalty provisions.
I could address the increase in the maximum fine per violation, because I proposed it. The $1,000 level was established in 1977, 30 years ago, when the laws were first enacted. And when I first served on the board a year ago, I just commented that this is a fairly low amount of money in terms of, and again, it's more of a deterrent rather than, you know, some kind of financial gain for the board, and that it has been 30 years, and there would be, just from inflation, it should be increased. We had a discussion about that initially to $5,000, and then it was recommended. Then the board agreed to $10,000 again to make it more of a deterrent. And again, it's a maximum penalty, and it's not a required penalty, but it would give the board the option. And mainly, it's for language to kind of strengthen the law and let registrants know that there is, you know, potential ramifications for poor practice.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me the civil penalties if you issue them and they're collected? Do they go back into your agency? Or do they go into the state general fund?
Yes, Senator Byer, I can address that. Our board is completely fee driven. It's fee based, so it would go right back into our budget. But when we would have cause to levy such a civil penalty, that money would actually go into the state by paying the Attorney General's office for the legal services. We wouldn't be collecting the fee to try and bring up our budget or make money. It would really go back into the pockets of the AG office. We do have one case at this point in time where it's cost us about $30,000 already in legal fees, and that's just coming straight out of the registrant's fees.
Section 8, subsection B, makes this bill retroactive. Could you speak to why you want this power retroactively?
I'm sorry, I don't...
Specifically at language on line 39, where it says, reply to discipline action taken before, on, or after the date, effective date of this act. So that means that is retroactive.
Senator, I'm thinking that that goes in line if we are in the middle of an investigation at this time for a compliance case, and we have not yet... a recommendation has not yet been made to the board by the compliance committee for that case to recommend penalties. Would you agree?
We have a number of open cases now, and I suspect that language is in there in relation. It takes anywhere from months to years to settle some of these cases. And so I suspect that's why that language was placed in there.
You're talking about a case in which disciplinary action has already been taken, but there's a negotiation on an appeal? The section Senator Byer refers to looks to me like it's like it applies only to a situation when disciplinary action has already occurred.
That's what it looks like, yes.
What I would say is sometimes that if there's been a disciplinary action and we've requested of a registrant to either comply with our request, either to bring up their work to the quality, the standard that is expected and that their clients expect, and that doesn't happen, we then might seek civil penalties.
Kidding.
But like I say, it's been years since we've even levied a penalty against anyone.
I think we would have to clarify that with our... how that actually language came about. I would have to clarify that. I don't have a specific answer of where that came from, and I would have to clarify that with some of the other clarifications you asked for.
Well, why don't we leave it at that today? Get some clarification on that, and also on the first provision that we talked about with regard to civil immunity from civil actions.
Yes.
And
go ahead. Sorry.
No, actually, I was just going to wind it up. So, if you had anything else, now's the time.
Mr. Chair, I guess I didn't get a chance to address that immunity issue. We have a case, had a case recently where we're all volunteers. I will say that, and all the people that we use for our committees and experts are volunteers. One volunteer that we requested to review some work, in turn, was sued by the person that. Or a complaint was filed by the person that wrote the original report. So that's where that comes from. I'm not sure. But thank you.
That's helpful. I think we'll want to talk a little bit more about it before we move ahead. But thanks for your testimony today. When you get those things sorted out, once you get in touch with Ms. Marshall, our administrator, and she'll set something up with me, and we can sort through that, get more information to the committee before we come back again. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank
that will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 165. And seeing nothing further before the committee, we'll adjourn for the day.